I've been in Australia about 2 weeks. I've been here 2 days where I picked up a newspaper called The Australian. I'm from a little town called Bath in England, which is, you might have heard of it. Jane Austen walked past my front door a few hundred years ago. And I've been here 2 days and I picked up The Australian, and look what's on the front page. Destination Europe, the Jane Austen Trail in Bath. I felt so at home. I don't know if someone here arranged that, but it was a great welcome. So thank you, whoever was responsible for that. Now, it's 200 years ago that Pride and Prejudice was first published. This novel, written in a rural rectory and revised in a Hampshire cottage and published anonymously, like so many books were. And so many of those books at that time just disappeared. We don't know where they are, we know very little about them. And yet this particular one, from its quiet beginnings, went on to become a phenomenal, great global phenomenon. Even among non-readers, its name is known. If you go out on the streets today and ask people, have they heard of Jane Austen? Have they read any books? You get a very positive response. Its fame, its popularity, its influence on contemporary culture, they seem to be just increasing with every decade. Pride and Prejudice contains all the elements that have always been required for a good read. Romance, angst, mystery, intrigue. And the best thing is, they're all expressed in clear, accessible prose. Great rich seams of wit, irony. Things that appeal to Jane Austen appeal to us today. Her characters are really substantial. They almost step off the page and into our lives. Even Jane Austen found them so. 4 months after the novel appeared, she was searching for portraits of the new Mrs. Darcy and Mrs. Bingley in London art shops. She was convinced they were real. She also revealed to her nephews and nieces that Kitty Bennet married a clergyman near Pemberley, and Mary Bennet became the wife of one of Uncle Philip's clerks. So if Austen was thinking what happened next, is it any wonder that so many contemporary readers do? So let's have a quick little look at the history of the book. Jane Austen was living in a little village called Steventon in Hampshire when she began work on an early version of it in October 1796, just before her 21st birthday. This is the house she was living in. Incidentally, the building was demolished 20 years after she and her family moved to Bath in 1800. But in the last 6 or 8 months, there have been excavations on this site. And on May the 17th, 2.5 weeks' time, there's going to be a major press conference explaining what they've found there. The house was demolished, it turned into field, and until last year, nobody had actually gone looking under the turf, looking under the soil to see what there was there. So I have no inside knowledge, but I understand they've considered it worthy of a big press conference. So we may find out a lot about the life of the family that lived there. She finished writing the book in August 1797, age 21 and a half. And she gave it the title First Impressions. An excellent title. And arguably a lot better title than Pride and Prejudice. First Impressions springs from the first impressions that Elizabeth Bennet forms of both Fitzwilliam Darcy and George Wickham. 3 months after its completion, the book had been widely read by her family and widely admired. Her father, the Reverend George Austen, wrote on his daughter's behalf to a publisher called Cadell, inquiring whether they would like him to send for their perusal. A manuscript novel comprising 3 volumes about the length of Miss Burney's Evelina. Now, whether Mr. Austen chose to mention Evelina because it too is a novel in similar form, or because it was a runaway bestseller in 1778, who knows? But the publisher wrote back by return, declining even to look at the manuscript. It must be the missed opportunity of all time. Did Jane Austen know the rejection? We don't know. It might have been her father trying to help her very quietly. Maybe the family discussed it. And news of the rejection only came to light many years later when the publisher's offices were cleared out. But with a title like First Impressions, it's perhaps inevitable that someone else would get in first. And in 1801, a novel called First Impressions by Margaret Holford appeared and sank without trace. So if she ever hoped to publish her manuscript, Jane Austen would have to find an alternative title. In the same year as this setback, the Austen family parents of the two unmarried daughters, Cassandra and Jane, left their Hampshire rectory, as I mentioned. Jane had lived there the first 25 years of her life, and they moved into Bath, a big, bustling city, centre of the social world. They rented a house in Sydney Place, attended the balls at the new assembly rooms, which look just like that today, with the exception of the cart. And a few, lot of cars parked out here now, but they look exactly like that today. The upheaval, the busy social life, lack of privacy of a town, the death of her father in 1805, and then they're moving round from one set of lodgings to another, first in Bath, then in Southampton. They all contributed to a long hiatus in Jane's writing career. But nevertheless, her knowledge of balls in assembly rooms would have proved invaluable for her research. It was not until 1809 when the sisters and their mother moved to Chawton Cottage, which is near Winchester, southwest of London, on the Hampshire estate of her wealthy brother Edward, that Jane really felt settled and able to embark again on any substantial writing. And this time she was determined to be published. The phrase Pride and Prejudice, printed in capital letters, occurs three times in a single paragraph at the end of Cecilia by one of Jane Austen's favourite writers, Fanny Burney. She must have known of it long before she chose the title First Impressions, but now she needed something else. It has the merits of being alliterative and is good shorthand for the faults that keep our hero and our heroine apart. We who love the novel can't think of it as anything else but Pride and Prejudice. It must have been quite difficult for Jane and her family. They spent 13-odd years with this unpublished book known as First Impressions. The new title also chimes in very well with Sense and Sensibility. Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility. Sensibility was the first novel Jane sent out into the world from Chawton Cottage. It published late in 1811 and with the help of her brother Henry. At that time, he was a prosperous London banker, and through his advice, she entered into an arrangement with publisher Thomas Egerton. It was published on commission, Sense Sensibility. That meant she undertook to reimburse Egerton if it made a loss. More likely, her brother undertook to reimburse him, because Jane had very little money of her own. But conversely, any profit was hers after costs such as printing, advertising, commission were deducted. It's not quite vanity publishing, and a perfectly respectable procedure for the time. Jane's personal allowance was little more than £20 a year, and she'd had a legacy of £50 in 1807. Maybe she held that in reserve, case of losses. But the first edition of Sense and Sensibility sold out, making her a clear £140, the first money she had earned in her life, and a very unusual thing for a woman to do at that time, especially a middle-class woman. So the double gratification of earning money and seeing her work in print must have been immense, really rewarding. At the same time, she was evidently busy revising First Impressions. We don't know exactly what she revised. The first edition, the manuscript of First Impressions is missing. The manuscript of Pride and Prejudice is missing. All we can be sure of is that, in her own words, she lopped and cropped so successfully that it must be rather shorter than Sense and Sensibility altogether, and it is. She sent Pride and Prejudice to Egerton before the full success of her first novel was known. But she was very keen that he should buy it this time. Why should she take the risk being successful? She'd hoped to have £150 for it, as eventually they settled on £110. She wrote, "It's being sold. I hope it will be a great saving of trouble to Henry, and therefore must be welcome to me. But by selling the copyright, she knew that she would make no further profit from this, nor would her estate. It was made for the most unselfish of reasons, but a sad decision, which came to seem even more regrettable when Sense and Sensibility went into a second edition. It's been calculated that if Jane had gone the same basis as Sense and Sensibility with Pride and Prejudice, she would have made £475 in her lifetime. And with copyright laws as they are today, how much more might her estate have made under a different regime?
What would that be worth today?
Thousands. We're worth thousands today. Tens of thousands, no doubt. In July 1813, Cassandra, her sister, was visiting her brother in Steventon when Jane wrote excitedly, "I want to tell you that I have got my own darling child from London." More than 15 years after publisher, she now held Pride and Prejudice in 3 volumes in her own hands. She also had the pleasure of seeing it advertised in the London Morning Chronicle at a cost of 18 shillings, 90 pence, just under a pound. So very expensive, bearing in mind her own allowance was only £20 a year. But her name didn't appear anywhere. It was then the convention to publish fiction anonymously, certainly when it was by a woman, even sometimes by men. It would have been a reviste, gauche, and perhaps some modern-day celebrities could learn from this, to then push her own name forward like that. The title page of Pride and Prejudice said, "By the author of Sense and Sensibility." The title page of Sense and Sensibility said, "By a lady." Doesn't take you very far, does it? A Chawton neighbour, Miss Ben, was dining with Jane and her mother on the very day the volumes arrived. Jane told Cassandra, "In the evening, we set fairly at it and read half the first volume to her." Lucky Mrs. Ben, or Miss Ben. So the plot, let's get to the plot. It's essentially a love story. Boy meets girl. Mr. Darcy meets Elizabeth Bennet. But they have a very awkward meeting, don't they? They conceive an immediate dislike of one another. So blinding is the effect of this antagonism that for a while they even refuse to acknowledge they've got any sort of powerful attraction. And as one advances in forgiveness and understanding, the other recedes. There's a dance-like courtship, don't they, dancing around. And of course, the denouement comes when the man performs a selfless service for the woman, proving his true worth. Both learn lessons about themselves, which make them better people for the future, carry their values to the next generation. And of course, the conquest of a proud man's heart provides an additional frisson for us. What about our heroine? Elizabeth Bennet, she's an inspired creation. Jane Austen herself admitted that she found her the most delightful creature ever to appear in print. Most male readers fall a little for love with her, and most female readers identify with her, it seems. Perhaps that's because she stands up for herself and adheres to her own sense of right and wrong, whatever the pressures of society around her. She fends off the snobbery from the Bingley sisters, from Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and she withstands conventional demands on how she should behave, including from people like Mr. Collins and her own mother. And Mr. Darcy's insult on their first meeting, well, just another attack on her own sense of self-worth, and she laughs it off. She really hasn't got much room for manoeuvre. No money or no inheritance due, but she's gifted with charm, spirit, wit, optimism, and she's also very attractive. One of Elizabeth's most attractive qualities is her good humour and to make the best of things that she can't alter. What of our hero? Opinions are mixed about Darcy. In film and television adaptations, he's shown as handsome, brooding, virile. But in the first reading, or even the second reading, his desirability is possibly a little less obvious. Jane Austen's got a very difficult feat to carry off here. She has to make her hero ultimately worthy of her heroine, but to begin with, he must be unpleasant enough to alienate Elizabeth. Right, not just at that first proposal, but right up to, sorry, not just that first dance, but right up to that first proposal of marriage. In fact, for at least a third of the book, we love Elizabeth, so we dislike Darcy. He's hurtfully rude. We're rooting for her when she scorns his insulting marriage offer. But Darcy does a very rare thing then. He listens to his adversary and takes on board what she has to say and changes himself. Not his inner nature, which beneath his proud manner is honourable, but the way he treats people, the way he regards them. He has no idea if this will woo Elizabeth again, but because he's convinced by her arguments, he wants to be a better person. Jane Austen knows she must produce further evidence of goodness, so she does. The testimony of his housekeeper, who talks about how humanely he runs his estate. And then the trouble he goes to of seeking out Wickham and bribing him to marry Lydia and save the family from disgrace. And he does it in secret without seeking any thanks for love of Elizabeth. But they're not the only two people in the novel. We also have the most wonderful dysfunctional family, the Bennets. Mr. and Mrs. Bennet are among the finest comic creations of English literature. The marriage of two such ill-assorted people. You can see how it happened, really. Think about it. 23 years ago, the young Mr. Bennet was taken in by Miss Gardiner's youth and beauty and that appearance of good humour which youth and beauty generally give. Oh, dear. And soon finding himself saddled with a narrow-minded and foolish, self-pitying woman from whom there is no escape, he retreats into his library and to his country pursuits for his solitary daily pleasures. But by shutting himself away, he also abdicates responsibilities as a father. He ridicules his children. He ridicules his wife. It's really quite cruel, some of his ridiculing, though it's all couched in terms of mock courtesy. But nevertheless, we rather like him because he has some wonderful lines. Remember when he puts an end to Mary's dreary piano playing? "That will do, child. You have delighted us long enough." And when Mrs. Bennet calls on her husband to make Lizzie marry Mr. Collins, Elizabeth is summoned to the library to hear what her father has to say on the subject. "An unhappy alternative is before you, Elizabeth. From this day, you must be a stranger to one of your parents. Your mother will never see you again if you do not marry Mr. Collins, and I will never see you again if you do." Elizabeth can hardly help smiling, despite the seriousness of the subject. But what sort of reactions did we get initially to the book? Henry, in his brotherly pride, actually rather gave the game away, even though the name wasn't published. He kept mentioning it was his sister to his well-connected friends. Jane wrote, "I long to have you hear Mr. H's opinion of P&P. His admiring my Elizabeth so much is particularly welcome to me." Mr. H was Warren Hastings, retired Governor General of Bengal and friend of the Austen family. She would certainly have been delighted had she known that another eminent man, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, was urging his dinner companions to buy Pride and Prejudice. And Miss Sheriff, who took his advice, wrote, "For it was one of the cleverest things he had ever read. The critical review felt that Elizabeth's sense and conduct are of a superior order to those of the common heroines of such novels. And the British critic found her character to be supported with great spirit and consistency throughout. There seems no defect in the portrait." Okay, these are reviews mainly from men. But the female population were just as likely to be thrilled. Annabella Milbank, this picture has never appeared in public, by the way, a fashionable young lady, wrote to her mother that the novel was a very superior work and that the interest is very strong, especially for Mr. Darcy. She would soon have her own dashing hero in her life, in the shape of Lord Byron, whose wife she became. Much good it did her. Even the Prince Regent, who was famous for his rather debauched lifestyle, bought a set of the three volumes for each of his residents. It's hard to think of the roistering prince doing anything quite as reading a novel, let alone sympathising with the characters. Now, I wonder who his favourite character would have been. Mr. Wickham? But he professed himself a devotee of all Jane Austen's works. Incidentally, she did not return the compliment. Though she did, of course, dedicate Emma to him, rather under a certain amount of duress. Not everyone was a fan. There's always a grumpy one. In the 1840s, the critic G.H. Lewis had recommended that Charlotte Bronte read the novel. She wrote afterwards, "I got the book, and what did I find? An accurate daguerreotype portrait of a commonplace face, a carefully fenced, highly cultivated garden with neat borders and delicate flowers. I should hardly like to live with her, ladies and gentlemen, in their elegant but confined houses." Charlotte Bronte later asserted that the passions were perfectly unknown to Jane Austen, a claim we find rather odd today, given our modern-day interpretation of Darcy and Elizabeth. The first publication to exploit Jane Austen's potential as a high-earning author was a lot later, Alan Macmillan's 1894 edition of Pride and Prejudice. Beautiful plush production, blue, green cloths, the gilt peacock design, And what made it even more special were 160 line drawings by Hugh Thompson, who was paid £500 plus royalty of 7 pence for every copy after the first 1,000. He earned more money from this one edition than the author or any of her family ever earned. In just 1 year, 11,605 copies were sold. Another 3,500 was sent to the Americas. By 1907, that number had reached 25,000. Thompson's drawings achieved iconic status, and you saw one where I showed you the Bennett family. Well, of course, others were keen to join in as well. Encouraged by this popularity, the artist Charles E. Brock wrote to Macmillan & Co., promising to deliver another illustrated version of Pride and Prejudice. It came out in 1895. It printed on best quality gilt paper and had a frontispiece and 39 plates up onto alongside the text, all but one full page. And it wasn't only thought worthy of superior paper. The critics, beginning of the 20th century, began to enjoy it as too. W.D. Howells, the American novelist, claimed the novel had created an Austen cult and turned its author into a passion and creed, if not quite a religion. If only he could see what was coming later. For his friend and fellow novelist Mark Twain, the idea of a divine Jane Austen wasn't quite what he had in mind. He said, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and hit her over the skull with her own shinbone." Yet, notice how he rereads it. It held a certain fascination for him all the same. An early German translation came out in 1830, followed by a second in 1939. American editions became more prevalent from the 1930s onwards. A 1940 Hollywood film, which we'll talk about in a minute, promoted a special film edition of the book featuring stills inside and on the dust wrapper. In 1961, the year that Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space, Pride and Prejudice was published in Moscow, in English. The Russian translation was 6 years later. It can now be read in languages as diverse as Chinese, Sinhalese, Swedish. It's currently has recently been translated into Portuguese in Brazil, and the Emma is now being translated as we speak. In May 1938, when the transmitter at Alexandra Palace in London could only transmit television programmes 25 miles, and hardly anybody even had a television, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, aired a 55-minute version with 7 actors and 7 actresses filling all the parts. So the Times went to Trollope Publishing Review later in the week, was seen on the television screen. For this production, Mr. Bennett's daughters were reduced in numbers from 5 to 3. I suspect they kept Lizzie and Lydia. But actually was shown twice, which means the actors having to act it twice because there's no pre-recording in 1938. The first professional film adaptation, directed by Robert Z. Leonard, released by MGM in 1940, it starred Laurence Olivier and Greer Garson, aged 35, probably the oldest Elizabeth Bennett there's ever been. Remember the very opening? It happened in old England. Well, the opening words flashed onto the screen, evoking a time of moral and traditional certainties. For a wartime audience, desperately in need of a happy and complicated ending, whole swathes of the novel were omitted or ruthlessly simplified in. The huge success the previous year of Gone with the Wind had encouraged the director to set Pride and Prejudice in the 1840s, which allowed the costume designer to indulge herself in these gigantic hats and voluminous crinolines. Well, there were to be more series. 3 television series in the 50s and 60s, all 6-parters. Then an empty decade in the 70s. Then in 1980, Faye Weldon's 5-part series for the BBC. Almost an hour longer than the previous adaptations, but it was still filmed largely in the studio with harsh lights and fake gardens. Elizabeth Garvey attracted much critical acclaim, and she's still really involved in the Austen world. Gets involved at the Jane Austen House Museum in Chawton. A lot of Austen purists prefer this version, suggesting that Faye Weldon incorporates sufficient amount of dialogue from the novel. Yet there's still intrusive voiceovers, a bit of embarrassing slapstick quality, especially with Mr. Collins bumbling around to the strains of bass clarinet. But in this light, omitting the moving and tender exchange between Elizabeth and her father after Darcy's second proposal is really unforgivable. In any event, to a 1980s television audience, this must have felt like the definitive version of Pride and Prejudice. And then came this man, Andrew Davies, 15 years later. He and Sue Birtwistle were going to radically change the world's perception of Pride and Prejudice and spark a revival in all things Austen. Unlike previous serials, the 1995 production was no low-budget offering. £6 million in the money box. Each of the 6-hour-long episodes radiated period authenticity, no expense spared. 10 million UK viewers, more than the entire population of England and Wales when the novel was first published, became incurable addicts. 12,000 videos released in the same week as the final episode, and they sold in 2 hours. By the end of the following week, 58,000 copies had been sold up, and the subsequent worldwide distribution netted the BBC a far greater income than their initial outlay. Well, Jane Austen, claimed Andrew Davies, would recognise 80% of the dialogue as her own. He said, we could just lift it out of the book. He realised that the shorter adaptations had left out crucial scenes. He once said, her plot works just like a Swiss clock and doesn't have any flabby bits in it. Everything counts. There was no need, he said, to rewrite it. But it didn't prevent him from adding new scenes. Mr. Collins encountering a scantily clad Lydia on the stairs at Longbourn. And most famously, or infamously, Mr. Darcy diving into a pond and materialising unexpectedly in front of a transfixed Elizabeth. And you still get people looking, asking whereabouts in the novel they can read that bit. Andrew Davies justifies that wet shirt scene quite persuasively. He said, in that brief moment, one is reminded that Darcy, for all his responsibilities as the owner of Pemberley, is actually a young man. And by intercutting Elizabeth staring at his portrait with the flesh and blood Darcy, the audience sees, one is able to point up the idea that there are many portraits of Darcy being formed in the story. And there are. He's a aloof man. He's the owner of Pemberley. He's the lonely man, see, companion. There are many sides to Mr. Darcy. Whatever Andrew Davies' reasoning, and despite, or perhaps because of, accusations that he focused attention solely on the sexual charge, this production of Pride and Prejudice undoubtedly boosted sales of the novel, and it generated an insatiable interest in the author's life and times also. Period houses were carefully chosen to reflect the relative social positions of the characters, costumes. Carriages were selected to show their disposable income. It was all very carefully researched. And the National Trust in England is still reaping the rewards of the increased footfall in the properties featured, particularly Lyme Park, which is Pemberley, Belton House, Rosings. The owners of Luckington Court here, Longbourn, have benefited from a new roof on their house. It probably did need it, yes. Elderly, the middle-aged, young adults, teenagers, those barely out of their cradles, they all switched on to Jane Austen. And a whole generation of children, now women in their 20s, watched the 1995 version repeatedly with their mothers and fell in love with the story and the characters. And then we move into the 21st century. In 2004, Bollywood came up with its own tribute to Pride and Prejudice's universal appeal, Bride and Prejudice. It gives Jane Austen's classic a modern twist in a quintessentially Indian setting. And now writers of all kinds turn their minds to a myriad of possible and not always plausible scenarios. Pride and Prejudice on Mars, Fitzwilliam Darcy rockstar, probably the most improbable ones. Jane Austen's characters venture into the realm of the undead, and I think outside they have got Pride and Prejudice and zombies. No one's already bought it. Usually Mr. Darcy is leading the way. He fancies such as a vampire Darcy's desire and Mr. Darcy's bite. There's even Pride and Prejudice Hidden Lusts and Pride and Prejudice The Wild and Wanton Edition. So all these exploring the character's basic and perhaps not so basic sexual urges. The American writer Carrie Beberis constructs an entirely different kind of life for Elizabeth and Darcy. She turns them into reluctant sleuths and sends them off to Northamptonshire to solve the matters at Mansfield, or to Surrey to uncover the intrigue at Highbury. P.D. James, the doyen of detective fiction, wrote Death Comes to Pemberley last year. Love them or hate them. For huge numbers of readers and almost as many writers, the prequels, the sequels, the variations of the original fulfill a craving to squeeze as much pleasure as possible out of Pride and Prejudice. What would Jane Austen have made of it all? The Jane Austen Centre in Bath opened its doors in 1999 to an influx of tourists. Funnily enough, mainly from countries where the BBC series had been screened. Similarly, the cottage at Chawton I showed you earlier, where Jane revised Pride and Prejudice, is now the Jane Austen House Museum, and it's enjoyed an exponential rise in its visitors' numbers after 1995, from 30,000 a year to more than 56,000 a year. And we do wonder, don't we, how Jane Austen might have reacted to the world's treatment of her darling child. Would she still be capable of tracing its features, despite the extensive surgery that many have given it on film, on television, and on books? Could we ever offer to her the explanation about why a man in a wet shirt should be so fascinating? Would she turn pale and faint on the nearest sofa if faced with Pride and Prejudice and zombies? Or would she just laugh at the sheer absurdity of it all? Or maybe, given her once declared preference for pewter over praise, would she have asked for the royalties? But given our love for her lightest, brightest, brilliantly sparkling jewel of a novel, hopefully she would forgive us our predilection for making of Pride and Prejudice whatever we will. Imitation, after all, is said to be the sincerest form of flattery. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. That was a wonderful journey, taking us through from the origins to the present day. If you'd be happy to take questions.
I'd love to take a few questions, thank you. No? Okay, we'll go. No. Anybody?
Given that you write obituaries, can you tell us about Jane Austen's obituaries?
Yes, thank you. Great question. I think if you come to Flinders University in 2 days, you'll hear the answer. No, Jane Austen's obituary, such as it was, they're apparently, according to a very esteemed academic here in Adelaide, Dr. Nigel Stark, who's the founding father of obituary writing studies and is sitting on the front row, there were 11 obituaries for Jane Austen, various periodicals and newspapers, but they were very, very short. And interestingly, they started by referring to her father in Hampshire, in Steventon, Hampshire, the daughter of the Reverend George Austen. So the first thing we learn is that it's about her father. And then we get the authoress of Emma, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and which was the other one at that time, Nigel? Mansfield Park came later, didn't it? That was published with Persuasion posthumously.
No, not Mansfield.
Northanger Abbey, yes. So Persuasion. Because they only mentioned four of her novels, because the other two came out after her death. And that was all. There was no other obituary. Contrast that with Princess Charlotte, who many people now have forgotten, who died in childbirth while giving birth to the next line of the throne, who died 3 months later. And there are acres and acres of obituaries in the papers. Unsurprisingly, she was royal. But Jane Austen, so little known at the time of her death, even the books had only been published in the hundreds, not the tens of thousands.
The question that interests me is, obviously she was a genius in terms of ability to sort of capture human interactions and so on, but how far was her own experience in any sync with what she was writing about. At the age of 21, to come up with the first draft of a book like that, how far was her own experience in sync with that? I know she had some relationship issues and so on, but did they come within that period or later? Or
how? Yes, question is how...
For people at the back, did you hear that?
No.
The question was, how much was her own experience in sync with what she was portraying in her novel?
At the age of 21?
Yes, it's really quite remarkable that she captures so much in this, because such relationships as she had were pretty non-existent. She was engaged for one night to Harris Bigwither, who incidentally, houses for sale. If anyone's got a spare £6 million, you can read all about it in the new issue of the magazine. It's there, it's for sale. It's got a nice swimming pool. But Harris Bigwither end up with a nice house and a wife, and Jane Austen end up in a poor cottage and unmarried. We have no idea really where she got this experience from. She can't have had much experience of life. I think she must have drawn on what she'd heard and what she knew. Her family, her brothers were going up to London quite regularly, so she would have heard tales, and she herself went into town. She wasn't poverty-stricken in Steventon, but nevertheless, she had lots of other books around. Her father, George Austen, had a huge library, and very unusually at that time, he did encourage his girls, his daughters, to be educated. And Jane Austen, of course, played cricket, famously so. Not for England, but... But she did play cricket. But where she got so much intricacy from, so much detail, remains a bit of a mystery, for someone so young.
This isn't the question, but I read that when Colin Firth was offered the part, he turned it down, and his brother said that Darcy is sexy, and Colin Firth reeled backwards and thought about it, and then rang up and said he'd changed his mind and he would do it.
Yes, I believe that's the case. Colin Firth won't talk about it these days. He doesn't like the idea of being typecast, but he possibly should have thought about that before he played Mr. Darcy in Bridget Jones' Diary, which has certain similarities.
Tim, I wonder, who's your favourite Mr. Darcy?
My favourite Mr. Darcy? Well, I quite like the Matthew Macfadyen portrayal, but, and of course, everywhere you go and you mention Laurence Olivier, you get such a warm reaction, you can't think, but oh yes, perhaps everyone seems to like him, perhaps I'm missing something there. But I suppose without Colin Firth, we wouldn't have the magazine, and we wouldn't have the book and all the other books and many other things. So I suppose if I wore my commercial hat, I'd have to say Colin Firth.
That really bugs me, because we're celebrating 200 years of a great novel here, and we're not celebrating that person. And this is a book you pull off your shelf and you reread it again all the time. There are several of us here from the Jane Austen Society, and we talk about the novels.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely right. And the first and foremost are the novels. They've got to be. But without the adaptations and the films and the interest, an awful lot of people wouldn't have read the books. A lot of people come to the books having seen the films. And it's not meant to be an elite, exclusive club, the reading of the novel. It's for everybody. I'm sure Jane Austen wrote it for everybody. So I quite agree with you. The novel is the primary, the most first and foremost. But I was talking about its after effects, its effects, and that's why I tried to get not just Colin Firth, though I knew he'd sell books, but also to get ideas from the line drawings, from the Brock drawings, the Thompson drawings, from the film, because just to give the idea that it does create a wide different set of interpretations. I think everybody who reads the book interprets it in their own mind in a different way, and the more the merrier.
Could I ask one more? I just believe it. In all these spin-offs, I've been talking about this, one little spin-off I read in your magazine, you might like to share with the audience tonight, that is, there is a Pride and Prejudice board game, I believe.
There's a Pride and Prejudice board game. There's a Pride and Prejudice Facebook game. For those who are interested in such things, there are... You name the spin-offs? They exist. I haven't played the board game myself, but possibly over a drink or two we might try it one day. But yes, there are so many different opportunities, and the Jane Austen Centre in Bath, I think, sells many of these different things.
She was
emotionally, she seemed way beyond 21. Mm. But sociologically, she was way beyond her time, as well as being way beyond
yes.
her 21-year-old.
Oh, yes. She was way beyond her time, not just emotionally, but also sociologically, in many different ways. And this is probably why her work has sustained. And so many authors of this period have vanished. I'm convinced it wasn't just luck. She just happened to be the one who got lucky. There's definitely so much depth in there that people have come back to it and keep coming back. Even Mark Twain kept coming back, despite what wanted to do with her shin bone.
As you said at the beginning, making the best of things, that was a positive quality, but particularly around women's issues like not inheriting. No one's ever said it so well, and yet she's not bitter, she's not vicious.
No. She was arguably the first feminist.
Yeah.
Or one of the first feminist writers, if you like.
But
very graceful in so doing. And that's if she hadn't been graceful, she wouldn't have been listened to. Perhaps there's a lesson for us all in many different fields there. But yes, she really, if you stop and look and think, wow. And she addresses colonial oppression in the United States and slavery indirectly through later books. There's a lot in there that's very progressive. It's remarkable what she actually covers in these books.
Is there any evidence of her own reading? I mean, you mentioned Burney. But I'm not sure whether they overlapped. But would she have read, for example, any feminist works of her time, like I think Shelley's Rights of Women and so on?
I don't know what she actually read and didn't read, but her father had a very big library and he encouraged his girls. They did go to school in Reading for a while and were educated at home. And her father ran a classroom for local children. So, and she was, as far as we know, was very involved in that. So I think she would have read anything. And to write like that, you must have been a voracious reader, I'd have thought. I suppose there wasn't a lot else to do. Not many video games. Internet was down. Always is when you need it.
Tim, her favourite novel was Sir Charles Grandison by Samuel Richardson.
There we are. The answer. Her favourite novel was Sir Charles Grandison by Samuel Richardson. Thank you.
Do you have a favourite
book? I'm asked this regularly, and I can't keep trying to think of an original answer. But I come back time and again to Pride and Prejudice, because I think, notwithstanding reservations about his adaptations, it has brought an awful lot of people to Jane Austen, and once they have got over their wet shirt experience, there are lots of people do go on to read the other books. Emma, particularly, that's a great favourite. BBC did a wonderful adaptation with Johnny Lee Miller a couple of years ago. But so I suppose without Pride and Prejudice, a lot of people wouldn't get to the other books. So if you like, that's acts as a gateway. So I have a soft spot for it from that point of view. But of course, Northanger Abbey with its gothic content is quite fun on occasions.
I think probably we should close. So Tim, I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of all of us.
Can I do a bunch of these?